From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, House Republicans prepare their push to roll back our state income taxes.
States like Florida and Texas flourish, and they do not have income taxes. So that's kind of where we're looking at to kind of make that our success story as well in the state of Michigan.
A new Wayne County jail and a $1 billion development that could include a soccer stadium. Dan Gilbert's latest idea to develop downtown Detroit.
Potentially what you have here, obviously if they go through the due diligence, is the best of both worlds.
A Metro Detroiter comes home in the cast of the most successful show in Broadway history, The Lion King.
It's a true multicultural experience, and that's something that was very rare when it opened and is a little bit more rare than I would like, personally.
But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Governor Snyder's proposed budget for fiscal year 2018 came out this week. One thing it did not have was a tax cut, which is something many Republican lawmakers want to push through, and among them, Laura Cox. She's the chair of the House Appropriations Committee and the Republican representative for the 19th District representing Livonia. Representative Laura Cox, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
So tell us, what would you like to do with our state income taxes?
Well, I'd like to do, the House has a proposal out that we want to do an incremental tax rollback to kind of put a little bit more money in the pockets of the hardworking taxpayers across the state. I think that that's something that's a really big goal of ours, and we want to make sure our citizens get back more of their own money so that they can spend it the way they want to on their budgets, instead of sending it away to the state and feeling like they might not have as much control over it as they'd like.
And how are you proposing structuring these cuts? I'm kind of wondering, might you target working class families first and maybe get some Democrats on board?
Well, the way it's actually an income tax rollback. So it's going to be on rolling back the income tax in an incremental fashion throughout 40 years to eliminate the tax. So that's kind of our goal. So anybody and everybody that pays an income tax in the state of Michigan would see some savings and more money back in their pockets.
The governor has said, he was very clear, if you want an income tax cut, you got to show where you're going to cut spending or where the new revenue to pay for this will come from. He says he's open to talking about it. Would you consider looking at some kind of revenue enhancement somewhere in exchange for rolling back the taxes?
Well, what we're first going to do is, you know, and I think the governor is absolutely right. We're going to have a conversation. You know, we have to talk with our friends in the Senate and work with them as well as the governor. And what we're going to do is look at what he proposed yesterday, which, you know, we just got it yesterday, and look at the different programming that's going on. And we're going to go through a deliberative process and decide what we think that we can cut to actually make that tax rollback, put that money back into the pockets of the, you know, the folks throughout the state. You know, that's our first step. We're not looking to increase revenue in another way. Our first step is to try to look at in the budget as proposed, where we can actually make some cuts that make sense, cuts that maybe aren't having a return from the investment, those kinds of things. We're going to look at that first. You know, we have a $56 billion budget. I think that we might be able to find some agreeable cuts first before we even talk about increasing revenue.
And I'm sure you and Speaker Leonard and others who want to see this happen have been kind of thinking about that. What kind of areas do you think are there where cuts could be made? What might be at the top of the list?
Well, I'm not going to show my hand yet. We're going to try to dig down. I mean, we haven't even had his proposal for 24 hours, but we are working, you know, very diligently to try to look at different ways that we can actually make some cuts and make some sense. So we're going to, you know, I don't really want to show my hand because I really don't have a specific target yet.
But you must have been, I'm sure you've thought about areas where you kind of figure that's, that it could happen. I mean, I'm just kind of interested in what your thought processes have been.
Well, like I said, I don't want to show my hand yet. I want to be really careful. I have to make sure that everything that I want to talk about makes sense. And so right now, I'm just not going to shoot from the hip. I'm going to be really deliberative about what my plan is, and I'm going to work it through my caucus first. And so right now, I have our fiscal staff and our policy staff, you know, kind of going through the budget, drilling down and seeing where there are some areas that we can kind of capture some money.
Representative Cox, we think about Michigan history over the last decade or so, and we have seen some pretty significant tax cuts. We have cut income taxes. We've seriously cut business taxes. We eliminated the personal property tax. Those are a few of the bigger ones. And the Tax Foundation says Michigan ranks in the bottom half already, 33rd in state and local income tax collection per capita. But they also rank Michigan 13th in their 2017 Business Tax Climate Index. So our state, Michigan, is already more business friendly than the average state, and we already collect less income tax revenue than most states. Why do you think right now is a good time for another income tax cut?
Well, I just think it's really important that we remember all the hardworking folks around the state that are working within their budgets, that are dealing with their maybe flatline income, those kinds of things that they've been managing as expenses have gone up in life. And we want to make sure that we remember them. That's our goal, is to make sure that we take care of the taxpayers as well as the businesses. We have a great climate for businesses around the state, and we're happy that that's happening. We want to make sure we think about the hardworking folks out there that really can use that money.
But why right now? Why now?
Because we're able to do it. I don't know. I mean, I think it's a good time to do it. I don't understand. What do you mean by why now?
Well, you know, we've had some pretty big tax cuts, as we talked about, but at the same time, we think our roads and bridges, are falling apart. Schools.
The legislature came out with a roads plan for that last session. So we've addressed the roads and bridges.
How about the schools? How about schools? We've seen our schools go from some of the most admired in the nation to middling at best. We've got tuition at universities in our state less affordable. The decline in revenue sharing has hurt our cities, and we still have no clue what the long-term cost of the Flint water crisis will be. So these are significant problems, and how would less state revenue help us tackle those?
Well, you know, we're looking at the budget as was proposed by the governor tomorrow. We're funding our schools. I think that he had some wonderful programs. He is increasing the at-risk funding to different districts that weren't able to actually take care of those students that need that special care and need. He's giving more funding to high schools, $50 a student for every high school student, to kind of recognize that it's more expensive to educate a high school student, you know, given the various dynamics with the increased curriculum, those kinds of things. I think that we're doing a lot of really good things where we're paying down debt, we're saving money, and I think that there is room for this income tax rollback in an incremental fashion. You know, we feel really confident about it, and we're going to look at this budget and come out with some really, really good plan, and I'm looking forward to being able to lay that plan out here, you know, in the next, you know, month or so.
Kansas is often held up as a rather cautionary tale. We think about the fact since 2012, Kansas has eliminated income taxes for small businesses and significantly reduced individual income tax rates. So, and the economic growth and job creation has not lived up to the promises. And schools have suffered. They've had 9 rounds of budget cuts in just 5 years. And, of course, we know Michigan isn't Kansas. But I'm just curious, what did you find instructive from the way that Kansas went about this?
I don't really know except what you just told me about Kansas. I don't really know much about the Kansas situation. I haven't really looked at it.
Okay. What states have you looked at that might you look and go, you know what, that's working. I'd like to see this happen in Michigan. Do you have states that kind of have served as a model for you?
There are some. Basically, what we're looking at is, you know, we want to make sure that we're looking at the budget and being careful that we're not growing the cost of government, that we're not having government grow, we're reining in the size of government and making sure we're protecting the taxpayers of the state of Michigan first and foremost. So we're going to provide the services that we need, but we're also going to make sure that we take care of the taxpayers as well. You know, we've looked at businesses, we've cut business taxes, we've been very successful making, you know, companies want to come to Michigan. We've had some huge home runs in the last few years, and we hope to continue that momentum. And we want to make sure that we're also looking at the taxpayers as well.
What are some of the states that you have looked at to kind of give you some ideas in this direction?
I'm not really certain what you're talking about. I mean, we've been looking at a lot of different states. And, you know, my point is that I'm looking at the budget. We just got the proposal yesterday, and we're looking at ways that we can make these cuts to make sure that we're taking care of the taxpayers in the state of Michigan.
Let me ask you about Minnesota, because that is a high tax state. In fact, it's one of the highest, but their per capita income is nearly $8,000 more than ours. Their schools are consistently measured better than ours. And even with the high taxes, the big companies that are headquartered there, like General Mills and Honeywell and 3M and Best Buy and United Healthcare, they're all staying in Minnesota. Why is Minnesota not a good model for Michigan, in your view?
I didn't say that they weren't a good model, okay. Cynthia. I don't know what you're saying.
Well, they're a high-tax state. So it seems to be there, things that are working there with higher taxes in Minnesota. Why would we not maybe look at that and pick up ideas from there?
I don't know. I mean, our mantra in Michigan is to make sure, you know, that we keep taxes low, to make sure that businesses want to come to the state of Michigan, you know. States like Florida and Texas flourish, and they do not have income taxes. So that's kind of where we're looking at to kind of make that our success story as well in the state of Michigan. I don't know why Michigan can't try to wean themselves off of this income tax and make sure the state will still be successful and flourish. And if you do it in an incremental fashion, I believe that that would be the best way to make sure we're keeping, number one, the taxpayers in mind.
What kind of timetable do you have in mind, Representative Cox? As far as I know, you've got to dive into the governor's new budget. When do you think you might have something to put on his desk?
You know, we have a goal to do it at the, you know, he wants it done. We have a kind of a unofficial handshake agreement. Our goal is to have it done, you know, by early June.
So the public can kind of watch and so you should have
absolutely.
Something for people.
It's an open process. The process officially started yesterday with the governor, proposing his plan for his budget. And now the deliberation process goes through. And obviously, it's an open process. The public is open to all the meetings and the testimony and the hearings. And it's going to be a process that it's followed, you know, for years and years. And I think this would be hopefully the seventh year that the governor would have his budget well before the deadline. So that's kind of our goal.
A busy few weeks ahead, and we look forward to circling back and talking with you as this proceeds. Representative Laura Cox, who's chair of the House Appropriations Committee. Thank you so much for taking our questions today on Stateside, Representative.
Thanks, Cynthia.
Up next, behind the scenes of Lion King the Musical, and then winter fun in the UP, guessing how long it'll take for a car to plunge through the ice of a mine pit. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is the heart of winter, and there you are in the heart of the Upper Peninsula, wanting to raise some money for your community. If you're the Rotary Club of Iron Mountain Kingsford, you embrace the winner and come up with a pretty unique fundraiser, the Car Plunge Contest. Jaina Hootery of the Rotary Club is here with us now from Iron Mountain. And this is year three for the Car Plunge, Jaina, which is what exactly?
That's right. This is our third annual Car Plunge Contest. And what we have done is one of our members donated a car to the club, and we had the car brought to a local vocational education center. And the students in several of the classes stripped the car of all of its parts, everything. It's just been stripped. There's no fluids. There's nothing that could pollute this vehicle. And then it was painted a bright color so that it can be seen from quite a distance. And we placed it on the ice of something local here called Chapin Pit, which is actually a caved-in mine. And it's quite deep, and it's a non-recreational lake. We don't even call it a lake. We just call it a pit. And we put it out there, and this is our third year pushing it out onto the ice, and we put a webcam on it and link it to our club's website, and people can guess when that car is going to sink through the ice.
And I remember we talked to your dad on Stateside 2 years ago, the first year that this all began. And as I recall, he explained this really is not a new idea. People were doing it decades ago.
Yes, I think it's probably an idea that's fairly common in the northern states. It's something fun to do in the winter, in addition to all the other wonderful things that we do up here in the winter. But it's something fun. It keeps people occupied. People like to wager on things. And this way, for $10, you can enter three guesses in. And the person who is closest to the actual sinking time will win $2,000.
And so being this the third year, you've had a couple of years of this. And I'm interested in when the cars plunged in the first couple of years.
The first year we did it, it was April 4th, early evening, I think 5:41.
And that was a really fierce winter. I remember that winter.
It was pretty chilly up here that winter,
yeah.
Correct. And last year, it was a bit warmer, and we were all kind of nervous. It actually plunged on March 17th at about 1:57 in the afternoon.
What are you thinking for this year?
This year, it's been off and on. We've had periods of unbelievably warm temperatures, and then we plunge back down into the single digits. For instance, it was 1 o'clock when I left my house this morning. The high today is supposed to be 13, but yet in 2 days it's supposed to be 41. And we've been experiencing this kind of weird weather all winter. So I entered my guesses online the other day, and I chose dates that were all towards the end of March.
Interesting. Now, for the two contests you've had so far, how much money has this contest raised? I'm kind of curious about how well it's done for the community.
It's the Rotary Club that is running the contest, and the funds that we have raised all stay local. They go to fund our local community projects. We have done park revampings. We've built things for the community as far as like a viewing platform on one of the high hills in town. We built a bridge over a creek at a local park. We've done a lot of other things, but we also sponsor four scholarships to two area high schools every year. And so all the money that we raise from this contest goes right back into our local community here for those scholarships and projects.
And since people are going online, they're going to rotaryimk.org, and there you can find a link where you can buy three bets for $10. So you can track where people are from, can't you? And I'm just curious how far away some of these bets have come from.
Yes, I did check recently just to kind of see how the online guesses were going the other day. We've got a whole committee within our club that is handling the entries. They're putting all of the entries into spreadsheets according to the dates and the times chosen, so that when the car does plunge, it will be very easy to determine our winner. And I did take a quick peek, and we have a lot of people from Lower Michigan, and a lot of that is due in part the first year we ran it, the story was picked up by the Detroit Free Press, and that just really took off from there. We had inquiries from as far away as Germany, and it's fun that people are so intrigued with what we do here in the Upper Peninsula during the winter for fun.
Well, you can go again to rotaryimk.org, and the webcam is there. You can find a link, and again, three bets for $10. And how late do people have to place their bets? Do you have a cutoff date?
We don't have a cutoff date. What we decided to do this year, just because the weather is so iffy, we decided that we will allow the online guesses to continue indefinitely. But any entries that were received within 24 hours of the car plunge will be refunded.
What kind of car is sitting out there, by the way?
It is a 1998 Saturn, which if anybody knows things about cars, these early Saturns, they're just all plastic. So getting the car out onto the ice was really a piece of cake. It's so lightweight. there's nothing in it except the steering mechanism so that we can maneuver it once it's out on the ice. And we do have a cable attached. It is anchored to the shore because, of course, we have to retrieve it once it does sink and pull it out. But
you can recycle it for next year.
Absolutely. The car is really taking a beating the last couple of years when we've retrieved it. We had the windshield's now broken, but we're going to try and use it as long as we can.
Hey, it's doing its bit for the Rotary Club of Iron Mountain Kingsford.
That's right. And we really appreciate you asking about it. It's a lot of fun for us and a lot of fun for the community as well.
Jaina Hootery, we want to thank you so much from the Iron Mountain Kingsford Rotary Club, and best of luck with the big car plunge contest.
Thank you.
Now, That is the unmistakable open to the most successful musical in Broadway history. The Lion King opened on Broadway in November 1997, and nearly 20 years later, it's still going strong. It's grossed over $1.32 billion. The Lion King is at the Detroit Opera House for much of this month, and for one cast member, this is an extra special engagement. John Sloan III is a member of the ensemble. He's from Oak Park, and he studied musical theater at the University of Michigan. Hi, John. Good to have you with us.
Hi, Cynthia. How are you?
Great. Does it feel like a homecoming when you step back out on the stage at the Opera House in Detroit?
It really, really does. I've been blessed to be able to come home with the show a couple times before, but this time I think I am not taking it for granted. It's going to be my last time performing at the Opera House with the show, and it's just phenomenal for me to be able to be home and to be able to say that I've been able to step foot on a stage where I've, you know, watched shows when I was a kid.
When you consider between the film version when it came out in the early 90s and then, I mean, everybody's grown up with this score. And I'm sure for you to have, you know, watched it as a kid and now you are on the stage bringing it to new audiences has got to be, I mean, that's why people want to be performers.
You know, it's really interesting. I remember standing in line over at the Star Theater Southfield with my parents when Lion King first opened up on opening day. And it was hectic and everybody's, you know, crowded around and we're all excited. And then a year or so later, one of the first CDs I ever bought for myself there were two. It was the Boyz II Men Christmas Interpretations album and the Lion King soundtrack. And because I'm a violinist and you know, my mother and my aunts are music teachers, I found myself listening to the underscoring tracks a lot, listening to all the stuff that Hans Zimmer was doing and the orchestrations. And so then for me to book the show as an adult and to have the privilege of being able to be a part of it, I mean, for an artist, there really isn't anything else you could ask for.
John, when did you discover that you really not only wanted to sing and make music and act, but that you were good at it and it could lead to something that would be a professional path?
Well, I still know how good at it I am, to be perfectly honest with you.
Well, they hired you.
they hired me, right? I get paid for it, so I'll take that. I think, you know, it's tough to say. I've always been doing it, and for me, growing up with my image of musicians being church musicians and teachers, I wasn't thinking about that as a performance, as a career path. And so it wasn't until I was in high school that I started thinking about, you know, is this something that I really want to do? And my father is a counselor at Oakland Community College and teaches philosophy. And so when I was a sophomore, he started kind of picking my brain about, well, do you want to start looking at schools? You don't have to make up your mind right now. Like, what is it you might want to do? And I said, I think I'm going to go into public policy and political science and then pre-law. And he said, okay, well, what about the performing arts? And I gave him these very pragmatic reasons about why I wasn't going to do it. And I was like, well, you know, the number of people that go into it versus are successful and the average salaries and how, you know, making money and the travel, and it just doesn't seem like, you know. And he said, well, is there anything you enjoy doing more? And I said, no. He said, okay, so go to school for that, and we'll figure the rest of it out later. And I kind of looked at him with this, like, incredulity, because most parents say the exact opposite. Like, most parents are like, you want to major in what? Okay, how about you go and get, like, a law degree first and use that as your backup plan? But my parents have always been really supportive. So, I mean, I know it's a long way around the world to answer your question, but I don't think I would have ever believed that I could do it professionally if I hadn't had that push from my parents in the first place.
And I know your mother taught music in Detroit and still teaches middle school in Farmington, and you also came to the University of Michigan and you studied under the renowned George Shirley, whom we've had the pleasure of having him here on Stateside. And I got to wonder, John, does it feel as though the performing arts and music have been drowned out in the emphasis on the STEM fields and classes and science and technology? What do you think we lose when that happens?
So one of the things that I'm doing while I'm in town is I'm collaborating with an organization called the Future Project, and they're in Detroit, and we're putting together a young artist workshop on February 13th. I'm starting my own nonprofit called the Helping Hands Campaign, and a lot of the work that we're doing is around using art as a catalyst. And I completely understand and respect anybody that says we need to pour more money into the academics. Where I start to push back a little bit is in where you draw the line between what fields of study are more beneficial for a child than others. Children are different, and every child is different. And this is coming from somebody who is the brother of an educator and the nephew to an educator and the grandchild to educators, and this is what my family does. And you can't teach the same child the same way. And so when all we do is focus on one or two areas of study, we lose certain children. And we also forget that the arts, in and of themselves, have a remarkable power, not just to inspire, and I could say all these things that are, you know, kind of existential in nature. But I was teaching a class a few months ago, and it was a three-part thing, and I came in on a Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And the first Monday I came in, there was a little girl sitting in the back who was very, very quiet. She was very, very shy, and she didn't want to get up and move. So I said, fine, do whatever you want to do, do whatever, you know, you're comfortable with. The second class, she was moving a little bit more, and she was a little bit more into it. The third class, she was like, hey, Mr. John, so I was thinking about the choreography, and I was singing to the music, and I really want to... Now, this girl is completely tone-deaf and has no rhythm whatsoever and is never going to be a performing artist. But what I also heard from her other teachers is that she was more motivated in class. She mm-hmm. found more self-confidence. She was speaking and asking questions with much more frequency. And so what we can't do is push the arts, in quotes, off to the side as an extracurricular. And even with this integration of STEAM, where they add the arts into STEM, generally speaking, those speak more to the arts as they are approached academically. So they speak to a lot of design and a lot of visual art, and sometimes still manage to lose the performing arts. And so part of the workshop that I've put together on the 13th, we're starting in the morning by giving the kids an opportunity to redesign one of the puppets from the show. And we say, all right, guys, so here's one of the puppets from the show. How would you redesign this puppet? What is it you might do differently? One of the main goals is to break down and to obliterate that line between the arts and the academics. Because in a show like ours, we require both. We have a puppet master that travels with the show whose job it is to fix mechanically and electronically anything that breaks in the show, but whose job it also is to make sure that the colors are painted correctly and that there's blending, that there's artistry, so that when Zazu flies on the stage, he looks like a bird. And so we can't allow these two things to be so dichotomous, I think, because we end up doing our children a disservice.
I'm talking with John Sloan III, who is a member of the cast of The Lion King playing at the Detroit Opera House. He's from Oak Park, and among many things, he studied musical theater at the University of Michigan. What is your favorite song or moment in the show, John?
Ooh, that's tough. So I would say my favorite song or moment in the show that I'm not in is towards the end of Act One, after Mufasa dies. And it's this eulogy that is sung, and it's sung between the characters Rafiki and Sarabi and young Nala. And there's been all this craziness that's happened on stage, and, you know, Scar has come out, Mufasa has died, and there are hyenas everywhere. And then everybody leaves the stage, and these three women are left by themselves to mourn and to process this loss on their own. And it's sung completely a cappella, and the conductor actually puts his hands down or her hands down and lets the women sing themselves. And from a theater music nerd standpoint, I love the contrast. And I love the fact that everything's been crazy and now it's like really soft and quiet. But I also love the fact that it's, while it is a mournful song, I think it's also a song of determination. And when the show was being put together for the first time almost 20 years ago, they made a decision to change Rafiki. In the movie, Rafiki is a male character, and they made Rafiki a female character. They gave Nala much more in the show, and they really kind of wanted to balance out and lift up the idea of women's empowerment. And for me, that's one of the most perfect moments, I think, in all of musical theater.
Why do you think this show is still speaking so powerfully to people so many years later?
It's an iconic storyline.
It really, really is. It's so relatable to so many people. Everybody's had a moment in their life when they wanted their parents' approval or their big brother's approval or their grandparents' approval. Everybody's had a moment in their life when they've tried to step out of the shadows of somebody else and build their own legacy. And everybody's had moments of fear and anger and jealousy. And so the themes of the story are archetypal. And it doesn't help that there is a wonderful film that people still love and that resonates so broadly. And so I think, you know, that combination of people being able to connect with the show and with the story. And it was a show and that was and is so extremely unique in the way that it's told. I mean, our production pulls from a variety of storytelling techniques. And whether it's in the puppetry or in the Asian-style Balinese movement or in the fact that we speak in Zulu, Sotho, Swahili, and Xhosa when we're singing in the show, like it's a true multicultural experience. And that's something that was very rare when it opened and is a little bit more rare than I would like, personally.
Well, the work continues, and there certainly is certainly no slowdown in audiences wanting to see The Lion King, which you can do now through February 26th at the Detroit Opera House. And as you do, you will see John Sloan III, Southeast Michigan native, there in The Lion King. John, it was great to talk with you, and welcome back to Michigan, and thank you so much for spending time with us on Stateside.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to be here, and I would just hope that everybody really enjoys the show. And if they want more information about the outreach and the educational work that we're doing, they can just go to www.helpinghandscampaign.org, and I'm really, really thrilled to be home.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Still to come, Detroit billionaire Dan Gilbert offers a deal for Wayne County's failed jail site. Then, time banking or time sharing, people trading time and skills instead of cash, and how that benefits the community. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. You could argue that land development is akin to a high-stakes poker game, and Dan Gilbert has just tossed a pretty big card onto the table of downtown Detroit development. His Rock Ventures is offering to build a new jail, juvenile detention center, and criminal court complex for Wayne County. In return, Gilbert, Rock, would get the half-completed jail site near Greektown. Dan Gilbert has been eyeing that site on Gratiot to build a 23,000-seat Major League Soccer stadium and more. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes has been talking with the stakeholders about this offer. Daniel, let's give everybody a refresher course. Tell us again, why is there an unfinished jail sitting there near Greektown?
Simply put, the cost of the jail got way ahead of the estimates. The previous administration of Wayne County put a stop to the construction. There was a lot of dispute with the builder at the time, and it's kind of been mired in litigation and finger-pointing and a whole lot of other things. Since that time, Dan Gilbert has been continuing to expand his downtown empire and investment, including buying Greektown Casino. This piece of land is right on the eastern edge of downtown, and if anybody who's been down there has seen this, it is really ugly and a real eyesore, number one. Number two, it's not the best location. It's a stone's throw from Ford Field, a stone's throw from the Detroit Athletic Club, the Opera House, Comerica Park. I mean, it literally is right there in the middle of what is really becoming, and already is in a lot of ways, the entertainment district of the city of Detroit. So Dan Gilbert has basically said, look, I'm going to pay to build you a new complex on the other side of I-75. It's going to cost me roughly $420 million. You say it will only cost you $300 million to complete the existing site. You pay us $300 million, we will take on all the upside risk and all the additional costs associated with the new project.
And in return, Dan Gilbert, what, gets that site?
In return, Dan Gilbert would get conveyed to him that site. He would immediately tear everything down and start over. A lot of people in the media are talking about this as really the centerpiece is the soccer stadium. And while that could be a centerpiece, that's contingent upon Dan Gilbert and his partner, Pistons owner Tom Gorris, getting an expansion team from Major League Soccer. If they don't get the expansion team for whatever reason, he has pledged already publicly and his people have pledged that they would go ahead with a development anyway. It just wouldn't have a stadium. So it would have an offices, retail, residential, and it would be a gateway to that part of downtown.
I'm interested in kind of breaking down what the pros and cons are for Wayne County and its taxpayers. So what kind of questions should he be asking?
County Executive Warren Evans, I think, has got a very smart team. He's a very smart guy himself, and he's looking at this, and he's not precluding it by any means. He says, we're going to vet this further. I got to have answers to questions, and he should. He should answer those questions. Biggest thing for him is, what am I going to get for $300 million? If we go ahead with our own project, we're going to be in charge of determining what we're going to be getting. And it's important for listeners to understand that typically in government, you know, you have multiple bids. You vet the bidders and you pick usually the lowest bidder and what they're going to build for what amount of money. There is only one construction company in the country that is even willing to talk to Wayne County about this. I think one of the things that really concerns Warren Evans is that he doesn't have a lot of confidence that the county is really well-equipped to oversee a construction project of this magnitude, which is one of the things that I think makes the Dan Gilbert project more attractive to him, potentially, is that they're going to be the ones that do it. So I think one of the biggest questions for him is, what's he going to get? I think the Rock people, from my understanding, are fully prepared to say, look, the people we're working with, HOK is a leading international architectural firm that does a lot of criminal justice projects all over the United States. There are cities in the United States that people from Wayne County or their consultants from the private sector can go, they can see what the courtrooms are going to look like, they can see what the jail is going to look like, they can see what the finishes, the fit, all that kind of stuff is, what's being proposed, and then they can say, okay, this is what we think we're going to get.
For $300 million taxpayer dollars, you can either put that toward this thing that has been sitting because it was a mess left by the Fecano administration, or the same amount of taxpayer money gets you a whole new complex a little further away in what, does everybody kind of agree that's a better location?
The thing that people need to bear in mind here, you got it right. You know, it's $300 million. Whether they build it at the county site on Gratiot or they have Gilbert do it out at I-75. That's true. But what happens if Gilbert gets control of that site is the county gets a new complex, and the county and the city get a $1 billion development in the city of Detroit. And that $1 billion development throws off sales taxes, income taxes, real estate taxes that both the county and the city are able to get that they otherwise wouldn't get. Remember, a government institution like a criminal justice system, all it does is spend money. It's a cost center for a government. It doesn't create any revenue. It doesn't throw off any revenue, with the exception probably of the people who work there who are getting taxed,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of other kinds of tax, it doesn't create revenue. So potentially what you have here, obviously if they go through the due diligence, is the best of both worlds. You get the private development on a site and near into downtown, and you get a new criminal justice system that's not very far up I-75. It's basically between East Warren and East Forest.
Looking to the $1 billion development that could possibly include this soccer stadium, would tax dollars be needed there, the way the public is helping to pay for the Illich family's new Red Wings arena? Or would Rock do a complete finance?
You probably would see them try to get what's called a TIF, tax incremental financing, mm-hmm. which is saying, okay, we're going to create these jobs, they're going to create tax revenue, and we would essentially be able to skim off, for lack of a better word, some of that tax revenue to help pay for the project. Again, that becomes a really debate, and it's a bit of a circular argument because people say, well, the government's paying for it. But I think one of the other arguments is, well, okay, if they don't, and if we don't have the development, there aren't the jobs.
Yeah, and all the things
and the income taxes and all those other associated benefits that come with it. So you really have to kind of look at this and take a longer term view. And one of the things that Rock is pushing is saying, over time, the payoff to the city and the county will be enormous here. But the county politically is looking at this and saying, you know, I don't have 20 years. We don't have 20 years. We have a boondoggle here that they inherited and they have to deal with. One final point.
Yeah.
The county taxpayers have already spent $150 million on this site before the project got stopped. So they got $150 million in this thing. They are paying, through the county, $1.2 million a month on debt service on that project. And nothing's going on. And no matter what happens, they're still going to pay that $1.2 million a month. because the previous administration made that deal, spent that money, and the project fell apart, and now they have to continue to pay it and will continue to. So they will be paying that $1.2 million and then the additional cost of raising the other $300 million. It's very obvious to me that Rock really wants to make this thing happen. I mean, why would you take $300 million for a project that's going to cost you $420 to build, right? Mm. They are really bending over backwards, and I think they fully expect that Warren Evans and his team are going to do their due diligence, and if it's not done, and it probably is not going to be done by February 20th, that's fine with them, but they just need to keep moving forward on this whole project.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel House, thanks for helping deconstruct really a fascinatingly complicated piece of downtown development, and we'll be watching with you as this moves forward.
Thank you.
Vision.
The best and the brightest.
The next idea. When we really see each other, we want to help each other.
Matching up people who need a service with people willing to provide a service. And the currency is time. That's the concept behind a time bank. They're popping up around Michigan, helping people with little cash but skills to offer, and also helping people to connect with their neighbors. Kim Hodge is the executive director of the Michigan Alliance of Time Banks. Kim, welcome to The Next Idea.
Thanks. I'm happy to be with you today.
I want to start at the very, very beginning. What is a time bank?
A time bank is a community skill exchange. It's a way of saying we all have something to offer. We all have skills and assets, and we all have needs, and we could be sharing them with each other. So it's kind of a pay it forward or circle of giving program. I may drive you to the airport. You might walk someone's dog. That person might cook for somebody else, and another person might make a friendly phone call to someone who just got out of the hospital. So it's a way of saying, let's share our skills and resources with each other. It's all based on time. So 1 hour is 1 hour, no matter who you are and what you do. So you could be a doctor performing a physical exam or a 10-year-old child pulling dandelions from someone's yard. Time is the same for all of us. So it's based on respect and reciprocity. So it's about getting and giving. So it's not just normal volunteering, but we ask our members to get something in return for what you put into the time bank.
Walk me through how this would work. Let's say that I am willing to be the person to drive somebody to errands and help out. So how do I sign up and how do I make deposits and withdrawals?
There are local time banks in Michigan, generally based in a community. They're not statewide. You can't be a time bank member in Ann Arbor and sign up to do something for someone in Traverse City at this point, although that's something that could happen in the future. It is possible, but it's not really likely that that's going to happen. So local time banks have membership requirements, which include generally filling out a membership form, which could be a paper form or an online form, going to a new member orientation where you learn about what the time bank is and you are oriented on a software. There's an online database that we use from a program called Our World, H-O-U-R World. And then you put up your offers and your requests. You say, I'm Kim. These are the things I like to do. These are the things I don't like to do and I need some help with. And so there's an online listing of each of the offers and requests. So if you wanted to drive, you would join, post that you're willing to drive. You would say when and where and how someone could get in touch with you. And then you might also look to see who, if anyone, has already posted that they need rides somewhere. Mm-hmm. Sometimes rides are needed in advance and people are going to the doctor's office or something like that. And sometimes if I blow a tire, I need a ride home. So I need to know who's available when. That's how it works.
And then it isn't that I drive you and then I get you to do something for me. I just, if I need something fixed, I can look at the database for the time bank and go, oh, Mike can do that. So that way I've got time in, I get time back.
Right, right. I might fix your whatever it is you need fixed, but probably not. It could be someone else.
Yeah.
That's why it's not trade. It's not barter in that way. It's more the circle of giving. Again, the pay it forward system. You drive me for 2 hours, you get 2 hours in your bank, and you can spend it wherever and however you want.
Wow. Is there an optimal size for a time bank? Does the size matter?
It matters only in that if you have about 150 people, you probably have a pretty good variety of services offered. So a lot of time banks that are smaller, and many of them are, we don't have 150 people in the time bank where I live, for instance, don't have things like skilled tradespeople in them. So sometimes you need a plumber, you need an electrician, or you need somebody who has a little higher level of skill in that regard. And you kind of need to reach out to those folks to see whether or not they're willing to offer up their services. You can do it on a much smaller scale, but you're only going to get whatever it is that people put into it.
How many time banks do we have in Michigan?
5 to 8, probably, because there's some that are just kind of bumping along. I'm not sure how well they're doing. We don't hear from them as much as we do from others.
What does it take to make them healthy and to have a vibrant time bank?
A time bank can start with volunteers or members running it, but in order to be active and to be growing and thriving, it needs paid staff. And to survive over the long haul, it needs paid staff. There's a time bank in Lathrop Village where I live. There's one that includes the towns of Royal Oak and Huntington Woods and Ferndale and a lot of the southeastern, kind of the Metro Detroit suburbs. There's one in southwest Detroit out of Unity in our community time bank, and there's one in Pontiac. And there are a couple others that are in Ypsilanti and Ann Arbor. Small. There are others that have been active, and I'm not so sure that they're still active.
Now, here's something I've got to ask. How do you establish trust among these people in the time bank? By that, I mean, let's say I ask somebody that I see they're listing in the time bank to come paint my house. How do I know that that person is trustworthy?
Well, that's a great question, and we get asked that all the time. Number one, if you come to an event that we have, maybe we have a chili cook-off, and you meet the person who's the painter, or you say, I need help painting. Would anybody be willing to do that for me? Several people might say, yeah, I could do that. I'm not a professional painter, but I'd be willing to come over and help out. You would need to gut check it and ask questions just like you would be hiring someone to come and do the work for you whom you're paying. That's one way. You can also check in with people. There's usually a coordinator or several coordinators of a local time bank, and you can check in with that person and say, hey, I need some help, and who's the best painter? And then you can talk to the person and say, hey, what's your level of experience doing painting? Are you someone who does this just on the side and you're going to splatter paint all over, or do you know how to really do this? You never know. You never kind of know what you're getting unless you have a conversation and you build that trust with someone and you understand who has worked with the person in the past and is that person trustworthy.
When a time bank is working the way that it can do at its best, what are the benefits? What does society get, communities get, from having a good, thriving time bank?
Well, I think it's different for different communities and different for different people. And I think people get into a time bank for a variety of reasons. I can tell you that when I started the time bank in my community, I had lived in my home for about 12 or 13 years. I grew up in a small town in Pennsylvania where I knew my neighbors, and I did not know my neighbors here in Michigan. And I wanted to feel connected to my community. So that, for me, has been the huge benefit. I have friends that now, when I walk, I talk, and I know people, I can go out with my neighbors, I can play cards with them, and I can walk other people's dogs and play with other people's dogs and kids because I don't have any of my own, and I have that connection to my neighbors. And I've gotten a ton of help from people in my community. So I think it's different for different people. Loneliness, social connections, the social supports, being able to count on someone. I have neighbors who watch my cat when I go away now that I didn't know before. So we have a community of people who will look after each other's homes. There's so little right now, people knowing their neighbors and being able to connect with their neighbors other than maybe just waving, knowing the names, saying, hey, I've got a sick kid. I have to run to the hospital and take care of the sick kid. Can you take the pot off of my stove or whatever it might be that's happening where you have that trust built up with your neighbors? For me, that's what it's been, and I think that's what it is for a lot of people, feeling connected to their community.
Kim, there are people listening to us all over parts of Michigan who may be hearing this going, this sounds like something we should do. What would be the first steps to take in order to launch a successful time bank?
There is a lot of really good information on our website at mitimebanks.org about how to start a time bank. It takes one person or a couple of people saying, yeah, we think this is a great idea. But they really need to be able to gather a group of people, a small group, maybe 6-8 people together, and say, what would we like to do here? Is this just for the seniors in the community? What would our goal be? What would our focus be? And how would we work with the people in our community to make this come to light? It could be that it would work out of a church or a school or a senior center, or it could be just a couple of blocks in a particular community, say, we're going to start this within our 3-block radius and do this amongst peers. It's one person or two people, get another subset of people, 6-8 people, and then have a planning committee that says, this is how we're going to do it and grow from there. And our organization, the Michigan Alliance of Time Banks, is established to train and support and connect local time banks. So people really need to not try to do it on their own. Work with those of us who have done it, who have learned, who have lots of experience to share, our wisdom, our successes and our failures. So connect with us and we'll help you.
Kim Hodge is the executive director of the Michigan Alliance of Time Banks. And once again, that website, if you missed it, is mitimebanks.org. Kim, it was a great idea, and we want to thank you for sharing it with us on The Next Idea.
Thank you so much.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.